Honor.
May it please the Court, Deborah McIntyre-Yurkovich on behalf of Brian Davis. The concept of spousal support is an equitable one. As a result, the law in the Commonwealth of Virginia is clear that the needs of one spouse must be balanced against the other spouse's ability to pay in both the initial determination of support and in a modification. Because this balance is required, Driscoll v. Hunter and the unpublished cases that follow do not stand for the premise that once spousal support is determined, the payer must deplete all of their assets prior to being able to obtain an appropriate modification from the court. Unlike in predecessor cases, in this case, a material change in circumstance was found in both the husband's ability to pay and the wife's financial need. It would be inequitable to require Mr. Davis to continue to pay spousal support to Ms. Davis when the parties are now similarly situated and a spousal support award would result in Mr. Davis becoming penniless in the foreseeable future.
At the time the court entered the order, did Mr. Davis have the ability to pay that amount?
Your Honor, he had the ability to pay spousal support, but for the foreseeable future, no.
Now, doesn't that depend on future events?
It depends on future events but in this case, those future events are not speculative. There's only two financial matters that are occurring in Mr. Davis's life.
What if he died?
Well, if he died, certainly spousal support would terminate.
No, but if he died a year out from the award, then he would have the ability to pay for that 1 year period.
Your Honor, not necessarily. And this is really a balance between his ability to pay as well as her need. It's not just strictly looking at whether or not he has assets that he could potentially pay spousal support through. And one of the major errors that the trial court had committed in this particular situation is not balancing her need with his ability to pay. Specifically in this matter, if you look at the award of spousal support that was granted to Ms. Davis, her income and expense sheet indicates that she has a need of $5,200 per month. That need is premised upon her paying expenses for her adult children and some other erroneous expenses. She also has income of $1,345 per month. When you take that into consideration, $3,500 a month in spousal support is exactly what makes her whole and requires absolutely no depletion of assets on her part. To the contrary, Mr. Davis is in a position in which he can't even pay his own living expenses. He is running at a negative deficit of over $8,000 per month just to pay for his own expenses. That gets further compounded.
But didn't the trial court conclude those expenses were overstated?
They included they were somewhat overstated. However, the $8,000 just accounts for his basic living expenses. If you look at his income and expense sheet that was generated at the trial, those expenses are over $11,000. When you're looking at just housing, utilities, food, health insurance, his caretaker, as well as his service on the debt that he has to pay to North Carolina, it equates to a little over $8,000. Those are expenses he can't change. Those are expenses that he cannot get around paying. So he's always going to be paying those basic expenses. And he's going to always be running at that negative of a deficit because he can't change the fact that he only has $2,709 in income per month. That is out of his control. That is what the Social Security Disability Administration had awarded to him, and there was no evidence that Mr. Davis has the ability to continue to work. This is a case in which there were several errors that occurred in this particular case.
I interrupt you. I hate to interrupt you, but sure. Time goes by so fast when we're doing these arguments. Ms. Davis's $5,285 or approximate amount of monthly expenses, you referred to a portion of that is going to support her adult children. What portion of that is going to do that?
Well, if you look at her income and expense statement, which I believe is at 1546 in the record, There are several items that are listed on there that have asterisks next to them. For example, car insurance, and some of those other expenses in which she included expenses for her children. Those need to be taken out because certainly she should not be getting credit for payment for expenses for her adult children. In addition, she also had included expenses of $108 per month for hospitalizations, yet she's not been hospitalized in years. She includes $650 per month in medications, yet she had not produced any updated information regarding her medical expenses. She provided outdated information from 2015, yet this trial took place in 2017. When you look at the $5,285 in expenses, those in themselves are inflated. When you then take into consideration her income of the $1,345, an award of $3,500 per month either makes her whole or makes her more than whole, meaning that she's never in a position in which she's going to have to deplete her assets in order to be able to meet her own basic needs. On the contrary, Mr. Davis does not have that luxury. His expenses, even if you go ahead and take away anything that you feel is inflated, no matter what, are going to exceed $2,709 per month in Social Security income. He will always be running at a negative deficit. And that is a big distinguishment in this case from other predecessor cases. You never see such a situation in which there is such a negative deficit. In Driscoll v. Hunter, if you take in consideration the support award that was granted in that case of $2,100, you look at what his income was and what his expenses were. There was a differential of a negative cash flow of $2,400. If you add those two figures, the $2,100 and the $2,400 of his negative cash flow and his $3.5 million in assets, it would have taken Mr. Driscoll 66 years.
But doesn't Driscoll stand for the proposition that the court doesn't look at the source of a party's ability to pay, but simply the amount available to it? So it doesn't matter that these are assets versus income.
That is correct, absolutely, because for both parties, the entire financial picture must be looked at.
Okay, so why shouldn't the court, having concluded that he had a present ability to satisfy the award, based on both assets and income, the court makes the award now, and then at some later date when it is closer to when he's going to run out of money for the asset side, revisit that decision?
Well, Your Honor, I think that sets up a situation in which you're trying to create the parties to both run to zero, because then both of them are going to be racing to deplete assets. And I don't think that that's what the intention of the law is.
So suppose the accountant says he'll run out of money in 20 years. Is that sufficient to reduce the award? I mean, at what point do we say the depletion of assets is so immediate that it justifies a reduction of spousal support?
Well, in this case, it is immediate because it's a given that every single month he is going to be depleting assets by over $8,000 just to make his immediate needs. It is immediate in this situation.
But his total depletion is not immediate. It's not tomorrow. It's off in the future at some point.
Well, if you just doing the basic math with the spouse support award and his depletion, it would be 5 years. That is immediate and foreseeable. We're not talking 20 years from now, and I think that's really where the balance of this court.
How do we tell a trial court 5 years is immediate, 10 years is not? I mean, where do we draw the line? This is why abuse of discretion is the appropriate standard to use in these cases.
But that's where the court has to make a determination of in what situations is a manifest injustice going to be created? Because at what point can he seek relief? Is it 5 years? 1 year? How much money does he need to have in reserves? If he only has $3,500 left, at that point, can he go ahead and seek relief? Where is that line? And that's exactly where this case is of precedential value of determining where that line actually stands. Because Driscoll v. Hunter and the predecessor cases do not require somebody to go to zero before they're able to seek appropriate relief. That is not what the standard is. Mr. Davis's ability to pay is impacted currently. It is a 100% guarantee that unless some windfall of money comes to him, that he is going to end up running to zero.
But it's that unless that gives me some concern, because unless means there are events that would prevent him from running out of money, and you're anticipating that those events won't occur.
But those would be speculative events. Because when you're looking at the events that are not speculative, which is the income that he has no control over, and his expenses, those are not controllable. The other events are the speculative events, the winning the lottery, coming into an inheritance, coming into some other windfall of money.
On that, though, he has assets of 1.1 now. Does the record indicate what income he gets from those assets?
It does not, Your Honor, and there was no evidence put on that he's generating any income from those assets. The only asset that was determined was the $2,709 in Social Security.
I missed that, but it's not in the record.
Ms. McIntyre, I neglected to mention there's cross error assigned here, so we were going to extend the argument to 20 minutes rather than 15, and I tell you that because otherwise you'd been in your rebuttal, but you will have your five-minute rebuttal to address the cross error.
Thank you, Your Honor. Should I
continue? You may continue, reserve as you wish.
Okay, I would like to continue and then reserve the next 5 minutes then.
Okay, well, you'll have about 8 minutes left for rebuttal if you stop now.
Okay. What I do want to be able to draw the attention to the court is it's not just an issue in terms of depletion of assets, because both parties have assets in this particular situation. There's also errors that were committed in terms of not balancing Mrs. Davis's need with Mr. Davis's ability to pay, in addition only looking at Mrs. Davis's income and not her other financial resources. This is a situation, again, where, as I said, the award of spouse support made her whole. It required absolutely no depletion of assets on her part. The court did not look at what her other financial resources were in order to be able to self-support herself.
Counsel, whose burden is that? At the trial court level?
Well, I believe that it is Mr. Davis's burden to be able to put on evidence of her assets, and certainly there was evidence that was put on of her assets. She has $681,000 in assets, and she should not be rewarded for the fact that she depleted those assets over the years to pay for the expenses of her adult daughter. She certainly should not be, Mr. Davis should not be penalized for not expending his assets. They both were awarded during the final decree, the final divorce hearing, and she should not be rewarded for depleting those assets, because that's exactly the message that would be sending is again, this shouldn't be a situation where we're creating a race to zero, because that's exactly what's happening in this particular situation is that ultimately, if the court upholds the decision, Mr. Davis is going to have to come back at some other point to seek a modification. But the question is when is that? When he has $500,000, $300,000?
But isn't that exactly the question that we ask the trial courts to determine after hearing all of the facts rather than the appellate courts that are using that abuse of discretion standard and reviewing the court, trial court?
That is correct, Your Honor, and that's why one of Mr. Davis's requests for relief is to remand the case. Because based off of the letter opinion, it doesn't appear that that was contemplated. When you read through the opinion, there is no verbiage in there that indicates that the trial court had considered the depletion of his assets.
And that was argued to the trial court.
But it wasn't in the opinion. So whether it was considered or not, the opinion is void.
Can't we presume that the court understood the law?
Certainly, I would certainly hope so. However, this is a situation in which I believe the court erred when it came to the law. Not only when it comes down to the depletion of assets issue, but as I had mentioned before, not balancing Mr. Davis's ability to pay with Ms. Davis's need, as well as not looking at her other sources of income in order to be able to go ahead and support herself. I think that is a critical factor here because the analysis just doesn't stop with what Mr. Davis's ability to pay. This is a unique case in the sense that there was a material change in circumstance found for both parties. where you had a material change that was not just found on his ability to pay, we also had a material change found on what her financial needs are. The trial court determined that she had a lessened financial need because she now is the recipient of Social Security disability. When support was originally set, she had zero income. And because of that, the court was required to look at her for other financial resources. When you read the decision, it clearly states that she requires ongoing support because her income, her needs exceed her income. It has nothing in there about her other financial resources. The key word is there, her needs exceed her income. And so there's grave concern that that was not something that was considered in this particular case.
Ms. Pecatelli, you are now into your five-minute rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, David Zangrilli on behalf of the appellee, Ms. Merrill Davis. I just want to clear up one issue that Judge Beals asked about. Your Honor mentioned $1.1 million of assets. My position is the evidence showed that Mr. Davis has $1,687,000 of assets. And I calculated that in various sections of the brief as to all the different categories of assets he has, which add up to that total.
And the record shows that, not just the brief?
Correct. Okay. Correct. As Your Honor mentioned, we did in fact file a cross appeal in this case. It's our position that the trial court erred by reducing the spousal support from $5,100 to $3,500 per month. There was no evidence supporting the second prong of the test, meaning the second prong being that a modification of support was warranted. The husband, the ex-husband, Mr. Davis, certainly had the burden to prove either, number one, that he no longer has the current ability to pay spousal support, or number two, that my client, Mrs. Davis, no longer has the need for $5,100 per month in spousal support. It's our position that the evidence failed to prove either of those situations.
Well, I guess my question to you would be the same question I posed to Ms. McIntyre. Why are we up here deciding factual questions? Why don't we defer to the trial court's findings in applying an abuse of discretion standard?
I think Your Honor hit the nail on the head. We've got a lot of stuff in this brief, a lot of these arguments, but there's really only one question, and that's the one I think Your Honor raised when you asked Ms. McIntyre, at what point do we say that the depletion of assets is so immediate that support should be reduced? And how can the Court of Appeals essentially draw a bright-line test? I don't see how the Court of Appeals could possibly draw a bright-line test in this regard, except to the fact that I'll draw an analogy to, I think it was the old pornography case, is what I know when I see it. And the whole issue here is 5 years or 6 years or 7 years, is that a reasonably foreseeable period of time? I don't know, and I don't see how the Court of Appeals could say 2 years is a reasonably foreseeable period, but 3 years is not. But to me, it's I know it when I see it.
But that same argument applies to your argument that the trial court cut the spousal support by too much.
My argument is that the trial court should not have cut it at all.
Doesn't the same argument you just made, though, apply to that trial court finding?
It does,
because of the facts involved and because of the abuse of discretion standard.
It does to a degree, Judge, but I would argue that even under Mr. Davis's best case scenario, when he's saying my money's going to run out in 5 years if nothing changes at all, 5 years is way too far off in the future. That's what I'm saying, is I know it when I see it.
But didn't he also consider her receipt of Social Security benefits that were not considered when the award was originally made?
The trial court did consider that. That goes to
why isn't that something that it's appropriate for the court to look at, that she now has an increase in income every month that reduces her needs?
She has the court should look at that. That would be error not to consider that. But the point is that there's a distinction between income and need. The touchstone in all of these cases that we always read is that, and I've got a couple of them here if I can find them.
Well, need is expenses minus income.
Need is expenses minus income, but then need is a step further, meaning what is the need to maintain the standard of living that the spouse was accustomed to during the marriage? And that's what so many of our cases say. I looked at one this morning, Miller versus Cox, 44 Virginia App 674, 2005 case, which says, the purpose of spousal support is to provide a sum for such period of time as needed to maintain the spouse in the manner to which the spouse was accustomed to during the marriage.
The case law certainly says that, but when you have extenuating circumstances such as someone losing their job and having a very serious illness, as well as being almost blind and almost certainly going to blindness based on the diagnosis here, why isn't that something that totally changes the keeping the spouse at the same level of standard of living as she or he enjoyed during the marriage?
Well, I would say it's a two-prong analysis. The first prong is, has there been a material change of circumstance, which that, with everything Your Honor just said, we're not disputing that there hasn't been a material change of circumstance. But when you get to the second prong, as to whether or not it warrants modifying the spousal support, that's when you have to look at his ability to pay versus her need. And when you look at her need, I don't think there's any case law which says that just because there's a material change of circumstances, then the spouse is no longer entitled to be supported in the lifestyle they were accustomed to during the marriage. If there's a case that says that, I'm not aware of it. So it's our position that at court, first of all, the husband didn't offer any evidence as to what the standard of living was during the marriage. He didn't offer any evidence stating that now her standard is just the same, or that she doesn't need $5,100 to maintain the same standard of living. The only evidence, I believe, that was offered on this topic was my client's testimony, when she testified that she has new expenses, including medical expenses, including prescription expenses. And she testified that her new receipt of Social Security was being used almost exclusively to pay these new medical expenses. And her testimony was clearly that her standard of living now is significantly less than it was during the marriage. So it's our position that he hasn't proven that she doesn't have the need for the $5,100.
So when the equitable distribution was done, just moving to that for a moment, it was almost exactly an even distribution.
Correct.
And how do you respond to opposing counsel's argument that your client, through a number of significant expenses that she paid for her adult children or adult daughter, and it sounds like law school expenses or a very laudable expense, but an adult child that has depleted the assets she now has by a significant amount, why should Mr. Davis then have to get her back where she was when she didn't have to do that?
There's another case, and I'm probably mispronouncing it, ZIPF versus ZIPF. It's 8 Virginia App 387, 1989. In that case, the husband unsuccessfully argued, and this was an initial determination of support. In the ZIP case cites the Driscoll case. In that case, the husband was arguing that wife had significant assets and that he should not have to pay her support. And the court said, that's not the question. They held that the payee is not required to exhaust her assets in order to qualify for support, number one. Number two, she has the right to spend her money how she chooses, and I don't think she can be penalized for that. I'll add that the evidence also showed that Mr. Davis was spending on his income and expense statement significant expenses for his adult children to the tune of about $1,900. I was just looking for them. I cited them in my brief. Health insurance for the kids, $773 a month. $858 a month for his adult daughter's college tuition, $95 for telephones for the kids, $200 for the daughter's food, and $60 for the daughter's prescription. The evidence showed that my client has in fact been reducing her assets for more than just the expenses for the adult children. She had, I think it was $843,000 as part of the equitable distribution award, and at the time of trial she had $681. And that delta was more than the expenses that were proven at court that were spent on the adult children.
Well, do we have any case law that requires a court, when reconsidering the original amount of spousal support order, do we have any case law that requires that court to maintain the wife in the standard of living she was accustomed to at the time of the divorce in perpetuity?
I'm not aware of any.
Because it seems to me that most people, as they age, at least the majority that have not anticipated retirement perhaps as well as they should, have a decreased standard of living. And basically what you're asking us is to tell trial courts that once they're divorced, the wife no longer has to worry about retirement because she's going to maintain that standard of living forever.
Yes and no, Your Honor. What I mean by that is divorce lawyers at the trial court, what I always tell my clients is the sad reality of divorce is that when one household becomes two, everyone's standard of living decreases unless both parties suddenly start earning more income. So I think the evidence would show that her income, her standard of living now is unquestionably lower than the standard of living during the marriage. If the court reduces her spousal support, it's going to be lower even further.
I mean, the cases do say that the court doesn't have to consider the factors that it must consider when originally awarding spousal support. And that kind of indicates to me that the court is a lot freer to balance needs versus ability than it was when the divorce originally occurred.
I agree with that statement. I think the court does have more discretion. But all I can revert back to is the case law, which all these cases, Driscoll and the other ones, keep saying that the beginning analysis is the husband's ability to pay. And unless he can prove that he doesn't have the ability to pay, or unless he can prove that the wife no longer has the need, and if you look at her expense statement, even if you discount...
The ability to pay, though, that could be based on all kinds of things.
Absolutely. Income
including
plus...
Including assets.
Income plus the use of principal of assets.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
But in this case, you know, when you look at it, and the trial court didn't say this, but it's pretty obvious, what the trial court did is just said, I'm going to reduce spousal support by the amount you're now receiving from Social Security benefits. She's held harmless. She has the same amount of income that she did at the time the divorce occurred. I mean, what's unfair about that?
What's unfair about that is that her expenses are still exceeding. So her expenses, if you look at her income expense statement, she was still running a negative deficit each month. And this is what I was mentioning a moment ago. Whether or not you subtract off expenses for her children, she's still running a negative deficit.
Well, do we have any cases that say that a party who spends more money than originally awarded in the divorce can use that fact to come in and ask for increased spousal support?
We're not asking for increased.
Well, that's really what you are asking, because she's receiving effectively the same amount of money that every month that she did when she was divorced.
She is. That's correct.
So she's just increasing her standard of living a little bit.
Her standard of living post-divorce is remaining the same, and it's our position that her standard of living is still below the standard of living that she was accustomed to during the marriage. And so if you don't decrease the support, plus you add in her Social Security, her standard of living is still below what it was at the time of the divorce. That was her testimony. Bear with me one second. In Mr. Davis's brief, he repeatedly states that the parties should be on equal footing. I don't believe there's any support in the case law that says that. What his position is essentially that she should have to use all of her assets, but he doesn't want to have to use his own assets to continue to pay support. And this goes towards, similar to what Your Honor asked a moment ago, as people age, generally their expenses do decrease. But if you look at the evidence in this case, Mr. Davis' standard of living is as high as it was, if not higher than it was during the marriage. I quoted in my brief numerous expenses that he's incurring, and he stated that he has no plans to reduce his income, even though he's now asserts that he can no longer see and can no longer work. His expenses
you mean
aren't changing.
Reduce his expenses?
I'm sorry?
Reduce his expenses or income? You said he had no plans to reduce his income.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Judge.
Okay.
He has no plans to reduce his expenses. I think I asked him the direct question, and I quoted in the brief about his cable expense, his cable television expense. He claims he's blind, but yet he has no plans to cancel his cable or his Netflix account. He's still going to shows. He's still going to the theater. He has two different gym memberships. So he's asserting that his standard of living should not change at all, and that he shouldn't have to dip into the principal of his assets, yet she should have to dip into her assets to support herself. Again, that argument was unsuccessfully made in the Zip case. And I cited a lot of cases in my brief, and as I pointed out, Mr. Davis has not cited a single case which stands for his position. Only one of the cases I cited was support actually reduced as opposed to the clerk flat out denying the husband's request to modify or terminate support. And in that one case, I think it was Cook versus Cook, the payee, the ex-wife in that case, did not appeal the decision. So that issue was not before the court. And I'll just conclude with saying that under the case law as I read it, the court has to look at the current circumstances. And there's no question that under the current circumstances, Mr. Davis still has the ability to pay. As Your Honor mentioned, there's a myriad of things that could happen in the future which could affect his ability to pay either positively or negatively. He could get married. He could move in with someone. He could the stock market could increase significantly, thereby increasing his assets. Conversely, the stock market could go in the tank and he could have less assets. That's a decision that needs to be made in the future. But I don't think the court should be speculating about what can happen in the future. I think the court can only look at the current circumstances. And unquestionably, he has the current ability to pay support from his income plus his assets, which are not dissimilar from many of the cases I cited in my brief. If the court doesn't have any further questions, I would conclude my argument.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the court's time.
Ms. McIntyre, you have your 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. McIntyre, could I ask you, how do you respond to opposing counsel's argument that your client really hasn't reduced his expenses?
There certainly is a recognition that my client does need to reduce expenses, and that is something that, during my closing argument in front of the trial court, had acknowledged openly and candidly. But when you do take a look at what his bare minimum expenses are, when you're taking out such things as the cable and the Netflix and extraneous expenses, when you're just looking at things like health insurance, the $2,000 that he owes to the North Carolina Department of Taxation, his housing, and his just basic utilities, you're still coming up with a figure of over $8,000 per month. And when an individual only has $2,709 in income, you're running at a significant deficit of over $6,000 per month, irregardless of how he cuts those expenses. He's in a situation in which he has to run at a deficit just to pay his own expenses. And any award of spousal support just compounds that deficit. The analysis before the court is not about whether or not he can pay the current amount of support. Because if that was the case, the parties we looked at, how much money do they have that month, and if they can pay the amount that was awarded that month, then that should be the amount.
Ms. McIntyre, from your last comments, it sounds to me like the only decision by the trial court that you would find to be appropriate in this case would be a total elimination of spousal support, because no matter what is awarded, it's going to reduce, he's going to run out of money.
That is correct. I mean, absolutely.
So is that your position, that if the court awards any spousal support or does not decrease it to zero, it would have erred?
Yes. I mean, certainly my client's position is that the termination of spousal support was warranted given the fact that he is running at such a negative deficit. However, if the court does not believe that that is the error, there are certainly other errors in this case, which are the imbalancing of his ability to pay with what her financial needs are, and only the consideration of her income and not her other financial needs. So certainly if the court makes a determination that the trial court failed to consider those factors, then it does need to be remanded for the trial court to take a look at those particular matters. As I was indicating before, this is about the ability to pay ongoing support. There's no question a material change in circumstance was found in this particular case. And once a material change in circumstance is found, it either has to impact the payer's ability to pay or the payee's financial need. There's no question that, in this case, that the payee's financial need had been lessened by her Social Security disability amount. In terms of Mr. Davis, the payor, there clearly was an impact on his ongoing ability to pay. At the time support was initially set back in 2009, he had $18,000 in income. With a $5,100 award, he had over $12,900 per month to pay his expenses. He was never running at a negative deficit. There has been such a drastic change in his financial position that impacts his ability to pay, because he no longer has $12,900 to pay towards his expenses. He's running at a negative deficit. That negative deficit is further compounded by the fact that he has the expense of a home caretaker due to his disability, which was not accounted for in the past. That is $1,200 that, irregardless if you look at his other expenses, that was not in place back in 2009, that has to be taken into consideration currently. And certainly the award that was granted by the trial court, it appears that the only thing that was taken into consideration was the amount of Social Security disability that Ms. Davis was receiving. The additional factors in this case regarding the assets of hers were not taken into consideration. The factor that Mr. Davis has a lesser ability to pay due to having to expend $1,200 per month for a home caretaker. The fact that he is now running at such a negative deficit. Those actually go to that second prong of the argument that not only was there a material change in circumstance, but his ability to pay has been affected. It's not about whether or not you can pay the current amount. It's about whether or not your ability to pay has changed. His ability to pay has changed. It has lessened. There is a lot less money for him available to pay support. This isn't just about assets. Both parties have assets in this particular case. Both need to be looked at. This is about, on a monthly basis, the parties are now very similarly situated, and he should not be put in a situation in which to compound his depletion in order to be able to maintain her at the standard of living, when ultimately what's going to end up happening is he's going to be homeless in order to be able to accomplish that goal.
Thank you very much for your argument. The case is submitted. We will greet counsel, and then we will take up Gonzalez versus Gonzalez. Be seated.
It gets tight with each chair.
I know. Evangelia Gonzalez versus Rafael Gonzalez, Mr. Abahini and Ms. Kersey. Oh, I'm sorry, Ms. I apologize. Ms. Abahini, do you wish any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 5 minutes.
That's fine.